Hello again, I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on this day after Election Day, Wednesday, November the 3rd. And we will talk about the election results again this hour, probably concentrating on the presidential contest, but we can also look at other state and national races. But because of the uncertainty, the presidential contest is on most of our minds. Word is now that the Bush administration believes that President Bush has been reelected, even though John Kerry has not officially conceded. The Bush campaign says that the lead the president has in Ohio is insurmountable, even with the uncounted provisional ballots. But the Kerry campaign disagrees and says every vote should be counted. We will welcome your thoughts and questions as we go over the results and look to the future. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Toll free from anywhere. In Madison, 263-1890. 263-1890. We are happy to have with us this hour John Coleman, Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, and he joins us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Were you surprised by the results when you got up this morning?
Well, the results were, I think, surprising in one respect, which is that President Bush had a lot going against him, and when you come out of it, he's got a popular vote majority. We have all these rules of thumb that we like to point to. If a president's approval rating is below 50%, if most of the country thinks that we're off on the wrong track, if the economy's growing weakly during the first half of the year, if the Washington Redskins lose on the weekend before the election, we have all of these indicators. If the challenger picks up the plurality of new voters, first-time voters, independents, moderates, all of these things, we say, make it difficult for a president to win. And lo and behold, it looks like the president probably has won.
Yeah. How come?
Well, this was a mobilization campaign, quite clearly, and the Kerry folks got a lot of new voters out. The young voters did swing toward Kerry, I think, pretty impressively. It was about 54-55% of young voters went for Kerry, and Democrats would be happy to see that happen in every election if they could keep that up. But the Republicans, in a somewhat of a quieter mobilization campaign, they had indicated that they really did want to get more Christian conservatives out, more evangelical voters out, because Karl Rove was pretty convinced that they had missed about 4 million potential voters back in 2000. And we'll have to take a closer look at the exit data as everything pours in. But I suspect that that mobilization effort really paid off.
Yeah. Do we know about the voter turnout exactly in the country and here in Wisconsin? It was considerably it was record breaking, that sort of thing.
I was trying to get a sense of that with the numbers this morning, and I know that was where most of the talk was, and I wanted to be able to join in that happy conclusion. But I'm not seeing a huge increase in voting. In 2000, we had about 115 million votes cast for the president. This year, it looks like, at least as of now, obviously we have all these provisional ballots and so forth, so that'll change things. But it's about 122 million, so it's an increase, but it's not what I would consider to be a gigantic increase. Just population growth would account for some of that. Wisconsin, we did have a bump up. It looked like it was about maybe 250 to 300,000 or so, but we had a similar bump up from 96 to 2000 in Wisconsin. So actually, even a little bit larger. So I think there was an increase, whether it was the kind of increase that people were expecting and quite as dramatic as people were expecting, I'm not sure. The national numbers are kind of tricky anyway, because do we really expect a big increase in California, New York, Massachusetts, Texas, places where the outcome was pretty obvious? I don't think we expected a huge increase there. So you may have, we may, when we finally see it, it might be that in the Florida and Ohio and other places we had a big increase, but other states, you had it pretty much the same as 2000.
Let's focus in a little bit on Ohio. From your standpoint, is the Bush campaign correct that the president's lead is pretty insurmountable, even if they do count all these provisional ballots?
Well, it's a very tough lead to overcome. It's about 150,000, I think, was the last numbers I saw on that. If the Kerry people are right that there's 250,000 provisional ballots, and we don't even really know that yet, the Secretary of State thinks it's more in the range of 175 to 200,000. But let's say that there were 250,000. Some share of those get thrown out. Let's say 80% of these are held to be valid. So we've got 200,000 provisional votes. Kerry would have to just do astronomically well in the provisional votes in order to make up the ground of 140,000 votes. So on that basis, it looks difficult. There are a couple of wrinkles here that haven't gotten much attention. One is that we have overseas votes, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure what the number is for Ohio. In fact, they really can't know. They can know how many ballots they sent out. But those had to be postmarked by yesterday, but they'll allow them to come in anytime over the next 8 or 9 days or so. So if the election is anywhere near close after the provisional votes are counted, we have to think about those, the overseas absentee ballots. The provisional votes, by the way, can take anywhere from 7 to 10 days to get all that cleared up, too. The other issue is, not to bring back terrible memories of 2000, but Ohio is basically a punch card vote state. 70% right. of their ballots are punch card. So let's imagine that the provisional vote does get things close, although it would have to get it really close, so 5 to 10,000 vote margin. With Bush still ahead, you could imagine a scenario under which perhaps the Kerry campaign might say, you know, this is a punch card state. We know the problems with these. They're well documented that these ballots have problems. Maybe we should do a recount to see what the margin really was on Election Day. Now, this is entirely, I mean, I haven't heard anybody suggesting this in the Kerry camp, but it wouldn't be an unreasonable thing for them to do, given what we know about punch cards. They may feel that that's not best for the country and would not want to go that way.
Yeah, does it hurt us, our democracy, our country, our leadership in any way to count these out, wait this through, and not have a declared president on the day after the election?
I don't think it's a major problem. It's not like 2000 where we were really getting into weeks and then months, and at some point you felt maybe something had to be done, and to some degree the Supreme Court may have, as a lot of folks view that ideologically, it may have simply been pragmatic on their part. They felt that it needed to come to an end. But if we're talking a day or two or three or even a week, I don't think that's any major kind of problem. I think it would be best for our democracy if we're pretty sure the person who got the most votes won. I think that would ultimately look better. To some degree, whether Kerry concedes or not is irrelevant, because if these votes keep trickling in and it did change, if he conceded and the outcome actually changed and he won, then obviously he's won when the electors go and vote. I would be more concerned if we were determined to rush to judgment and not count the ballots, all with the caveat that I do think it's pretty unlikely that the recounting, mm-hmm. naughty word to say, that the additional counting will actually change the outcome. But if people cast ballots, provisional ballots, even if they're provisional, why wouldn't we want to count them?
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the results we do know about. Maybe not every single state, but it was a good night for Republicans, you say.
This was a good night. The Republican Party has clearly established itself as the majority party in American politics. It's not a overwhelming majority, but it's a clear majority. They picked up seats in the Senate. It looks like it'll be 54, maybe 55 in the Senate. They had the additional pleasure for them of knocking off the mm-hmm. Senate minority leader. They picked up seats in the House, which didn't make the margin huge there either, but they picked up another three or so seats in the House. We haven't had a time for over 70 years when the Republicans have held on to the House this many elections in a row, so we're looking at something quite historic in terms of the party's strength. We also have a Republican president winning re-election, and winning with a majority of the vote. And it hasn't been since George Bush's father back in 88 that we've seen a president win a majority of the vote.
So does he have a mandate, and what does that mean if he does?
Well, I think they'll certainly look at it as a mandate, because this election was about George Bush. It was about his issues. Much of it, at least, was focused on Iraq and terrorism, the president's education bill, but certainly Iraq and terrorism being the big issues, and the economy as well. And a majority of the voters gave the president the thumbs up. So I would be shocked if they would view that as anything other than a resounding victory. And that means nominating people to the Supreme Court that they believe are in line with the administration's philosophy. It means continue to push on their agenda. I can't see any message in this election where the administration would say, we need to slow down and make a change in course in any policy area. How would you read it that way if, in fact, you've just You've just won a majority. You've picked up millions of votes from where you were the last time, and you've brought some senators and House members along with you for the ride.
Yeah. We have full lines, Professor Coleman, so let's take some calls, see what's on people's minds. Chester and Edgar has been waiting. Hi, Chester. You're on the air.
Hello. Assuming that the Bush dynasty is going to proceed, what has me worried is that Vice President Cheney only was along for the ride to get reelected, and now he will have a medical reason or some other reason to resign, and President Bush will appoint a lackey that is even more extreme right wing. I'm wondering, how does the president choose, if Cheney had an illness, for example, how would the president pick who his new vice president would be? And I assume that's going to happen quite shortly here.
Okay, well, I can't say whether that will happen, but the president has the obviously can choose who he wants to appoint to the position, and I would be surprised if he'd go in what's being described here as a strong conservative direction, in the sense of extreme conservative. I would guess the president would want to pick somebody that he thinks has a good chance of winning in 2008. So it might be a place to put a, who knows, a Rudy Giuliani or somebody like that, who they may want to set up for a run the next time, and he'd have the added pleasure of kind of sticking it to John McCain if he did that too.
Speaking of next time, Hillary Rodham Clinton's name keeps on coming up. Do you think that's the next time for the Democrats?
Well, it looks like she'll run. Whether she, obviously we're really speculating,
right.
Whether she would get the nomination or not, who knows? She's obviously quite popular among Democrats. It's hard for me to imagine her as being a terribly competitive national candidate. The Democratic Party has a real problem with building a national majority. There's in presidential elections. You've got to go all the way back to Franklin Roosevelt. Since Roosevelt, you've got exactly one Democrat who's managed to get over 51% of the vote, and that was Lyndon Johnson in 1964. Nobody else has managed to do it. So the Democrats, with the coalition they have, they've not been able to find a good formula to get a convincing national majority. It's hard for me to see Hillary Rodham Clinton as the answer to that particular question.
Yeah. Professor Coleman, talk a little bit about our map of red states and blue states. I mean, it's almost completely red, except for this northeast area and the upper Midwest, including Wisconsin, which went to Kerry, and then California and the West Coast. Otherwise, it's all red. What's that all about?
Right. Well, I think there's a couple things going on there. One is that we're looking at the somewhat more urbanized areas of the country mobilized, if you want to say, against the less urbanized. So you're seeing the Midwest, and you're seeing the Northeast, and you're seeing the West Coast, but particularly the Northeast and the Midwest. Traditional areas that Democrats have tried to do well in, heavy union concentration and so forth. So we have that sort of on the economic front, I think. And also a kind of what we used to call in the 80s, we don't talk about it much anymore, but the sort of the Rust Belt, Sun Belt division, and what kinds of policies would be preferable for people in those two regions. And I think that divide is still there. The other is cultural, and it clearly the South and the Mountain States are overall more culturally conservative. That tends to benefit the Republican Party. The coasts are a bit more liberal, and Democrats win pretty easily there. And then we have our area of the country, which is pretty evenly split. I mean, we don't want to overdo the red state, blue state, because obviously within states you have a great deal of variation. But that being said, I think it's on those axes of culture and economics that the parties seem to be different enough to people that we are getting what's this fairly consistent pattern. If you look at the map this year, and it's not it's hard to see much difference between this year and last year, and that's, I guess, another one of the striking things about this election is, after all this time, all this money, all this emotion, all this intensity, we are pretty much where we started.
Yeah. We're going to take a short pause and then take more calls from listeners about the election results. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. 263-1890. Our guest is John Coleman, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Newsmakers, lawmakers, authors, and experts. You'll hear from them all on the Ideas Network. We look for guests from different perspectives to talk with you on a wide range of topics. If you appreciate new ideas and a variety of viewpoints, keep up with the talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from IMS, working to empower the effective enterprise by providing custom business applications, application integration, business process management, and content management systems on the web at ims.net.
It's about 22 minutes past 8 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, talking election results with our guest, UW-Madison political science professor John Coleman. Kathleen Dunn also talking about the outcome of the election in her hours, as will Ben Marins between 3 and 6 this afternoon, as will Talk of the Nation. All sorts of opportunities to get updated and receive some insight and analysis on the Ideas Network all day long. Let's go back to the phones and take our next caller, Jack in Eagle River. Hi, Jack. You're
on the air. Yes, hi. Just to show you how I feel this morning, I just changed the recording on my phone, and I said, this is so-and-so and so-and-so. If you're from Ohio, please hang up.
Oh, no.
Two other observations very quickly. The thing that scares me as a progressive Democrat is that Bush governed as though he had a mandate when he had lost the election. God help us now. And the next thing, well, comment on that if you would, because didn't he acted as though the majority who voted for Gore didn't even exist, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I think it's somewhat more of a nuanced record than that, but he certainly did not shy away from embracing a bold conservative agenda in some regards. On the other hand, here's a president of the Republican Party who proposed no real spending cuts in the last campaign, nor in this one, who signed on to, ultimately, the prescription drug benefit, a huge entitlement increase that had conservatives quite upset, who agreed to campaign finance reform after not being terribly happy about the whole idea of campaign finance reform, which was really much more of a liberal issue. The domestic discretionary spending went up actually pretty dramatically. Again, not something conservatives were particularly happy about. Now, that being said, there's clearly areas where he went in a much more conservative direction. My take on this is that they had two ways to read their election result in 2000, and what they saw was a Republican victory, and they won the Electoral College as far as they're concerned. That mm-hmm. was message enough. The Republicans won in the Senate, Republicans won in the House, the Republicans were winning state legislatures, they were winning governorships, and I think he interpreted it as a mandate in the bigger sense, that this is the direction the country has moved in, and it's inconvenient that I lost the popular vote, but I'm not going to let that prevent me from pushing an agenda that seems to be having some resonance around the country when you look at other levels of election. So I don't think he viewed it as a terrifically risky strategy, and I guess to some degree yesterday's result suggests that it wasn't a risky strategy to maybe assume a little more mandate than the numbers themselves would have indicated.
Well, one other thing I thought I would mention is, if I got it correct, Ohio lost more jobs than any other state, and isn't it ironic that they're the ones that are going to put Bush back in?
That certainly is ironic, given Kerry's mm-hmm. emphasis on it. And when you looked at the exit polls last night, for people who listed the economy as their number one most important issue, Kerry won overwhelmingly among those people. The question that we'd have to check in Ohio, and I'm sorry I don't have the answer to this offhand, but how important was the economy as a proportion of the voters, sort of saying that was the most important vote, or was the president successful in making terrorism or taxes the key issues, or perhaps moral and kind of social issues in general. But that would be what we'd need to look at in Ohio. To what degree things have changed in the last year. My sense is that the economy there hasn't improved dramatically in the last year, if much at all. But really the point is, to what degree did Kerry convince people that was the issue when there were other competing issues, terrorism being the obvious one?
The Kerry campaign seemed very optimistic with the voter turnout yesterday. The polls apparently had been tilting more in Kerry's direction in recent hours. They were hopeful of picking up Ohio. It just didn't happen.
It did not. Mm-hmm. And they did what they wanted to do. Now, to some degree, he was clearly disadvantaged in this election by spending a lot of time in the president's turf. Now, he turned that to good advantage, ultimately, but he did spend a lot of time talking about Iraq, which was, you had to, obviously. Mm-hmm. And for people who named Iraq as the big issue, Kerry won overwhelmingly among those people. So he used that issue effectively. But on the other hand, he was talking foreign policy a lot, between that and terrorism. And Democrats tend to be more successful when they're able to emphasize domestic issues. And he was not able to focus as much on some of these other issues as he might have wanted. Now, that said, in the battleground states, the advertising was fairly heavily healthcare, economy, and so on for Kerry. The news coverage, I'm not so sure, was quite as emphasized that quite as much, and I think focused a lot more on his position on Iraq and his attacks on the president on Iraq. So to some degree, his domestic message may have gotten a bit overshadowed by the foreign policy issues. The other thing they couldn't anticipate was, even if they got their own folks out, and they did a good job, it seems to me, in getting new voters out, but they couldn't anticipate or predict how well would Republicans be doing, and it seemed to be that Republicans did quite well in that, too.
Yeah. And speaking of which, Jake in Galesville is next. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. My comment was, first of all, I stayed up till I realized this morning that President Bush was unfortunately going to prevail and he won the popular vote. And I actually broke down, and my wife and I feel very demoralized by what has happened. And more disconcerting to us is to see how this fear was propagated and how that gave Bush his advantage, knowing that if he played to people's fears, that he could use that as a strong motivator and that would bring him victory. I wanted to comment too, now that I'm hearing more about the gay marriage ban, that also bothers me. What, in essence, we're saying is you don't have to be a good parent. You don't have to necessarily love your children or raise them properly. What you have to be is of opposite sex. And it's proven that heterosexual relationships are not very successful, 50% ending in divorce, whereas it's statistically proven that the most loving, most longest-lasting relationships are actually between two women. So we should be focusing on parents loving children, raising them in a healthy environment, as opposed to what gender they are.
Yeah, Jake, I'm afraid we're not going to be able to debate the pros and cons of gay marriage, but maybe Professor Coleman, we can talk about how that issue played in the presidential campaign,
right?
And
well,
the election.
We had referendums or initiatives in 11 states. All of them won overwhelmingly, and that may be one of those turnout issues that was a little hard to calculate, even if those voters were not necessarily inspired to turn out by the presidential campaign. There's at least a reasonable guess that a lot of those folks voting in favor of those bans were also inclined to vote for President Bush as well. So I think they certainly benefited from that to some degree. And that was a mobilization campaign going on parallel, let's say, to the White House campaign. They weren't really involved in that in any direct way. I was interested in the comment about the fear factor, and I'm not sure exactly if that was relating more to the terrorism, but I'm not so sure that I would pin that entirely on President Bush, because John Kerry certainly was spending a lot of time telling people that they were less safe now than they were before, and that the country was less safe now than it was before, and that Osama was still out there, and we obviously saw that last week as well. And among people who thought who thought that the Osama clip was an important factor for them, well, those folks tended to vote for Kerry. So I think I don't think it's fear-mongering. I think it's a a reasonable assessment to say terrorism is an issue. I think both sides were pointing that out. Kerry, really no less than Bush, than I can see. So unless there's some other kind of fear that was being referred to, I don't think I'd pin that exclusively on Bush. I think they were both, the candidates always do that. They're always trying to scare you about the other guy.
Right. Did I understand you correctly that the Osama bin Laden tape helped Kerry more than it helped Bush?
That seemed to be what the exit poll was showing last night. Those folks who said that it was, they thought that it was a very important factor in their in their decision, tended to go to Kerry pretty substantially.
And thank you, Jake. Mike in Fond du Lac is with us now. Hello, Mike.
Hi. I was just curious if your guest had heard of any of the reports that are coming out of Florida regarding possible count discrepancies there. And I only heard the one I heard once, the one report, and that was that apparently the counties had a turnout that was consistently over 10% more than what was reported in 2000, with the exception of these Palm Beach counties that all apparently had turnouts that were less than 2% more than what was in 2000. And those Palm Beach counties were supposedly all supposed to favor Kerry. And I was just curious if that was, if you could shed a little light on that.
Okay, I unfortunately, I had not heard that, and I haven't seen any data on it, so I can't comment really in any specific way about it. I guess one general observation would simply be that the discrepancy would have to be rather enormous for it to change any of the results in Florida. I think that was one surprise yesterday, that the Bush victory in Florida was a bit more convincing, I think, than maybe the polls leading up to the election showed. You'd need really astounding kinds of discrepancies to overcome the margin that Bush has in Florida. But I'm sorry, I simply haven't heard those reports.
Yeah, either have I. And are we expecting all sorts of legal challenges, in Ohio or elsewhere over anything?
Well, I think what may be saving us from that, we certainly were anticipating a lot, and probably anyone who went out to vote yesterday saw poll watchers keeping an eagle eye on things. But we have what we need for legal challenges to be lodged is really a close race in individual states. And we don't have that many that are that close. And obviously the really close ones are the three that are still out there. If let's say, for example, Bush took Ohio, even if he took Iowa and New Mexico narrowly, it wouldn't make much sense for the Kerry people to challenge those two states, because if you can't get Ohio, there's no point. So it does seem it's rather like 2000. It's boiled down to one state, and the margin would have to get quite a bit closer, and then perhaps we might see some challenges then.
Thank you, Mike. Next is Dee Dee in Madison. Good morning.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, indeed. I wonder what the guest, I would like to have him comment about what he thinks is going to happen within the Republican Party this time around after the election. The traditional conservatives, which have been the heart of the Republican Party, don't really believe in a great many of the things that Bush has been doing. How much we are in debt, empire building, big government. They voted for him, kind of the lesser of two evils. And furthermore, they're never really been a part of the religious right. What do you believe is going to happen to those conservatives within the Republican Party? What's going to happen to the Republican Party itself?
Yeah, that's a great observation. Mm-hmm. The party is clearly one that has the different kinds of conservatives in it. So we're talking about social conservatives, and we're talking about economic conservatives. And sometimes we're talking about people that are both, but often we're talking about people that are one or the other. Part of the question is, where do you go if you don't stay in the Republican Party or support it? And I don't think the question is really, would they stop supporting Republicans? The question is, to what degree can you get your issues to be the party's priorities? And that's what a party is about. It's a coalition of people who aren't necessarily seeing eye to eye on everything, but they will have to decide on priorities. The economic conservatives, I think, are likely to be trying to really push on Bush to become somewhat more fiscally restrained and maybe fiscally responsible as they would consider it. But they're not going to be arguing for tax increases, that's for sure, and they will want Bush to extend the tax cuts. So I think they'll be pushing on him to get some significant cuts in spending. Where that's going to be is going to be obviously a huge challenge. The Republicans controlling the House and the Senate, though, does help them. So I think they can feel some hope that they can get at least some leverage on spending, which is where they want to try to get it, even though, you know, one could argue taxes has been what's changed even more dramatically lately, but they're clearly going to go after spending. The social conservatives, I think, will be relatively happy in the Republican fold because the Supreme Court issues will be important to them. Those will be important to the economic conservatives as well. But the Supreme Court nominations of maybe three, possibly four appointees, I think that's what's going to matter to them. And they know that the Republican Party is going to not, I don't want to say dominate in the sense that they can force anybody through, but the Republican Party clearly has the upper hand as to who's going to be the new members of the court. So I think the party can actually live together reasonably well. And the fact that they're a narrow majority is something as well. They everyone in the party knows that if they defect from the party, if they don't cooperate, that the party becomes effectively a minority and the Democrats have the majority. There is something to that bonding effect of just being a bare majority. If the Republicans were a huge majority, then you might have factions that feel like they could sort of take a flyer and be obstructionist and so on. I just don't think that they'll make that calculation here, given the reality of the narrowness of their margins.
Thanks for calling, Dee Dee. Jan in Marshfield is with us now. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm a progressive, a liberal, a Democrat, and if the results turn out as they think they will, where does the Democratic Party go from here? What suggestions, or what do you see might happen in the future, or what is your take on this?
Right. Well, that's it's the part B of the previous question, I guess, about the Republicans. The Democrats have some soul-searching to do, I think, if they lose this. There's obviously two possible directions one can argue. One is that they need to go in a more left, liberal, progressive direction. The other is that they need to pursue more of the Clinton centrist, moderate, new Democrat strategy. One thing that we do know is that presidents have been elected from the South and the West over the last few decades. That's where they've pretty much all been coming from. We've had two Massachusetts Democrats, seemingly, if Kerry doesn't win here, two Massachusetts Democrats not fare very well. So the balance of power certainly has shifted to the South and the West, where you have a more conservative breed of Democrat as well as Republican. I think that overall, the conclusion will probably be that the Democrats need to move more in the direction of the Clinton moderate centrist New Democratic strategy. Simply because the results toward the Republicans have been pretty substantial and across all levels of offices. If this was just happening in the House or the Senate or just in the states, but it seems to be happening everywhere. And to some degree, the party wants to position itself where it thinks the voters are going to be. So my guess is that there'll be pressure to try to get somewhat more someone in that centrist mold. And I think that was one of Kerry's potential problems, is that he, from the start of the campaign, which did not start off well for him back in January, and then he reorganized, he got things together, and his focus was on electability. But he never quite put together, to my eyes at least, a clear policy agenda. It was hard to know what his priorities were, what his key issues were. And I'm not sure that people viewed him as either a Clinton Democrat or an old liberal Democrat or progressive Democrat. I don't think people had a terribly clear sense. And, of course, the Republicans were calling him a flip-flopper, so that added to the confusion that people had about him. I think the Democrats will want to make sure that they have someone who seems to be clearly identifiable as somebody in that sort of new Southern, new Democratic mold, because that seems to be where the votes are at this point in time.
We are talking with John Coleman, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, talking about the election results, looks like President Bush has been reelected, but we still have to wait for all the votes to be counted in Ohio. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Calling all Prairie Home Companion fans. Anyone who calls in during this week or next week's fundraising broadcast of a Prairie Home Companion will be entered into our sweepstakes to win a trip to Minnesota. The prize includes round-trip airfare for two, a four-star hotel room, dinner with a cast, and a pair of tickets to a broadcast of a Prairie Home Companion. No pledge is necessary to enter.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Madison Country Day School, a college preparatory school with an internationally developed curriculum, now enrolling students of all backgrounds in grades pre-K through 10. Financial aid information at madisoncountryday.org.
This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, talking election results this morning. Kathleen Dunn will be doing the same coming up after 9 o'clock. Professor Coleman, before we go back to the phones, we've been concentrating mainly on the presidential race that uncertain outcome at this time. Let's talk just briefly about the state of Wisconsin. Wisconsin did go to John Kerry a little bit more this time around than it did in 2000. We sent all incumbent Congress people back to Congress. We had one open seat in the Milwaukee area and made some history there, right?
Yes, we did, with our first black representative, and obviously of the same party as the preceding member, so the party balance that we're sending to Washington is the same. Wisconsin's a good place to be an incumbent, I guess, is the story of our election yesterday. The congressional races, for the most part, were not even reasonably close, which I think is a shame. We've gotten into a pattern here of uncompetitive congressional races, not to mention terrifically uncompetitive state legislative races in a state that we prize ourselves on our even balance between liberals and conservatives and how competitive the state is and so on, and our independent streak and all of that. We are remarkably uncompetitive in these elections, and voters here in Dane County, at least where I was voting, there were plenty of races that were not even challenged by the Republican Party. So you're either voting for a Democrat or a Green, and it's good to see a third party on the ballot in all of these races. But I think it would be nice for voters to have a choice between the two major parties, certainly, in all of these races. Granted that I'd have to confess that I'm really not sure what the difference is between a Democratic and Republican coroner, but it'd be nice to have a choice there anyway, I suppose. So we have gotten into this pattern that I think is a rather distressing one, and really our turnout is fairly remarkable given the fact that people have so few races that they really are choosing. The Feingold race is interesting because of the amount of money spent in that race was pretty significant. Mm-hmm. Feingold spent a little over $10 million, and Michael spent a little over $4 million. And that race perhaps should have been closer than it was, given Feingold's fairly narrow win last time out. I think you have to lay most of that on the Michaels campaign, which got off to a bad start. Many of the did not seem to reach out very much to the other Republican campaigns once they had been defeated. Normally there's some show of unity and there's an exchange of personnel and you get all of the best people in the winning campaign, and you didn't sense that was going on very much in the Michaels campaign. There seemed to be a bit of disarray. The advertising themes seemed to be rather, let's just say, unusual at points, not necessarily going after Feingold on his weakest points, perhaps, but actually talking about issues that he was emphasizing himself.
Right.
So there was a bit of disarray in that campaign, and that led the Republican Party to pull out after they had thought about throwing about $1 million, $1.2 million, into the campaign.
But then at the last minute, they said, here's $600,000.
They did that, and the polls at that time, it was about a 20-point gap. So I can't believe that they were seeing something in the polling that suggested that the race was winnable, even if they were, advertising time at that time would have been almost impossible to buy because they would have been all booked up. My guess, and it's entirely a guess, I don't know why they did that really, but my guess is that it was a fear of for future candidates. You don't want to sort of give the impression that we promise people
right.
money and then we pull it back, and so future candidates might be a little bit wary of getting into a race if they feel the party's going to sort of drop them like a hot potato when things aren't working out. So I don't know if it was a coincidence that the original amount was 1.2 and then what they wanted to give them was 600,000, but it sounds like it's not a coincidence to me. They met them halfway and said, look, we'll give you half the money and try to send a message.
Well, Tim Michael says he'll be back. What is it about Wisconsin that we have a Democratic governor? I know we always haven't, but we have a fairly progressive U.S. senator that we sent back to Washington, and Russ Feingold, another Democratic senator. We have Democrats high on the ticket, and then we have a right-leaning legislature.
Yes. Part of this is the effectiveness of party organizations, and the Republican Party organization at the state level simply is much more impressive than what the Democrats have put together. They've got the troops out there. They've got the fundraising. They've got campaigns that are reasonably well coordinated, where the state Democrats are not quite at the same level of organization, I guess I'd put it that way. We're also a state where, particularly at the higher level offices, I think this is where Wisconsin's independence comes in. We tend to flatter ourselves a little too much about this. Most Wisconsinites will vote a straight party ticket, just like people in other states will. That being said, though, we do have a tradition of looking at individual candidates and perhaps crossing party lines, not in huge numbers, but in enough to get them to win. So Feingold yesterday was getting the votes of a lot of Republicans who were uncomfortable with Michaels. Doyle obviously got the votes of perhaps enough independents, at least in his race. So I think at the highest level offices, there's always enough of a margin of people who won't vote the party line and will be willing to vote for the person that they think is the best in the job. So you get somewhat of a mix. But when you get down to the local level, well, there you're really dealing with more what are people's basic political predispositions. And if you're a Democrat or Republican, and let's face it, for most people, they don't know much about their state representative or their state senator. They've heard a little bit. There's been some modest amount of campaigning. They probably have very little idea what these people have voted on, but they know that they trust Democrats more than Republicans, or they trust Republicans more than Democrats. So you get that kind of high incumbency reelection rate at that level.
Yeah. For those keeping count, in the state of Wisconsin, Republicans expanded their majority by one seat in the Wisconsin State Senate yesterday while also maintaining control of the assembly in the election. Republican Dan Kopanky defeated Democrat Brad Pfaff in the contest to fill a vacant seat in the 32nd Senate District. We won't go through all the state results since we have lines full with people wanting to talk about the presidential race, so let me go back to the phones. Tim in Ladysmith. Hi, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. According to the national polls, apparently the number one issue that voters based their decision on was moral issues. And I think, you know, I'm a Republican, and looking at the Democratic Party, I think if you look at the amount of states that voted for President Bush, and if the number one issue is moral issues, which I think surprised the national media, I think you have to look at a couple of things. Number one, the Christian vote, the evangelical Christian vote, which was very mobilized in this campaign, but also the fact that I think the American people are much more morally conservative than we've been told by the East and West Coast, and that's very reflective in this election. And I think the Democratic Party is going to have to take a good hard look at itself if it ever expects to gain that kind of support again, because I see, if we're talking about a Hillary Clinton or people like that running for national offices, I see it becoming even more entrenched in conservative Republican electors, candidates and so on.
Well, I think I would agree with that in part, but disagree as well. Certainly, I think it would be wrong to suggest that the country is socially liberal on issues like abortion, on issues like same-sex marriage, which were the two, which are what I think are mostly being captured by that moral issue variable in this year's election, when people identified that. That being said, that if you look at a lot of these issues, an awful lot of people are in some kind of middle ground position. That is, they aren't anti-abortion, but they're not in favor of abortion under every circumstance. They're in favor of some kind of middle combination where abortion should be allowed in some circumstances, but not in others. Most Americans, as far as the polling seem to be indicating earlier at least, were not too enthused about the idea of a constitutional amendment about same-sex marriage, but they're willing to have it be something dealt with at the state level. So if you view that as where does that fall on the conservative liberal scale, well, that's somewhat more of a moderate conclusion. It says that some states, if they wanted to, could determine that same-sex marriage is okay. So we don't want to necessarily have a national rule on that. So I think the country is actually somewhat more moderate than I would say that it's either conservative or liberal. However, in terms of political mobilization, these issues do seem to be more important to people who are conservative, that they base their vote on it more than folks who are liberal. It tends to be more of a motivating factor for them to get to the poll. So when we look at the actual election outcome, then it turns out to be a more important factor. And one thing we know about election outcomes is that we're not getting a representative sample of the public here in terms of who turns out to vote. So we are getting some kind of non-representative or biased sample of the population that actually votes. So we're getting a lot of people who care deeply about those issues in a conservative direction. In that respect, I think the caller is right. It's one thing to say that Americans are centrist, but if it's not the case that centrists are basing their votes on those issues like abortion and so on, then the Democrats have to think, how can they appeal to people, how can they either get people to come out who are more moderate, or how are they going to handle this with conservatives? I don't think they're going to win conservative votes, but they obviously don't want to be mobilizing conservatives to vote against them.
I think Zachary in Milwaukee has an idea. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I was wondering if you think in the future we may find more of an emergence of Democratic candidates who are coming out anti-abortion more strongly. And I'll take your comment off the air. Thanks.
Well, I suppose in the South that might be something that you might see. It's hard to imagine it in the on the coast or up in the Northeast or Midwest. But if Democrats want to make some inroads in Southern states, that may be possible. I don't have a good answer for that. I don't think there'd be some major move in that direction, just given where the Democratic Party's base has been, and where they get volunteers and fundraising and so forth from. They get a lot of support from the pro-choice crowd.
That reminds me, Professor Coleman, of gender gap numbers that I was hearing about yesterday and last night and early this morning. Bush apparently did pull in those so-called security moms, the married women with children, and there was less of a gender gap between Bush and Kerry than there was between Bush and Gore.
It might have been down a little. It was still a fairly healthy gap. The women voted, the numbers I saw was about 52-47 for Kerry, men being more sort of 54%, mm-hmm. I think, for Bush, something like that. So a little bit down. Now, that being said, the gender gap is a bit of a it's an abstraction in and of itself, because, as you said, when you break it down, you start to see that the gap isn't quite a gap in the sense that women vote Democratic and men vote Republican. So, for example, if you look just at white women, white women have tended to vote Republican just like white men have, although white men have voted more Republican than white women have. So in terms of a gap, literally meaning they're on opposite sides of the issue, it's somewhat of a misnomer to point to the gender gap. You're right about the sort of security mom kind of factor as well, but that's been generally true. That is to say that married folks have been disproportionately Republican, single folks disproportionately Democratic. That's been true for the last several mm-hmm. elections. So there's nothing especially new there. It's Bush holding ground that he had already had.
Rick in La Crosse is with us now. Good morning, Rick.
Yeah, hi. See, I seen a graphic on TV early this morning that both in 2000 and 2004 now, from 18 to 29-year-olds, they only had 17%. And don't you think that's the big reason why he lost? They failed to get the vote out. And a second fast question here, you think that there was any kind of a backlash from all the movie stars and Michael Moore's movie that had would that have any kind of effect on it? Thanks.
All right. I don't think that the sort of celebrity factor would be a big negative. If it's a negative, it's a negative with people who were probably already inclined to vote Republican anyway. I don't think that would have ultimately swayed many votes. I'm not sure what the 17% was referring to, though.
Voter turnout. I didn't actually hear 17%, but that the 18-year-old, the young voter really didn't turn out in big numbers as expected. He's saying a 17% turnout of that age group.
Okay. Well, I think the turnout was probably higher. Maybe he's meaning 17% of the total number of people that turned out. One thing that we know from yesterday is that the youth vote was up, but the thing is that votes were up in all age groups as well. So people aged 18 through 24 or so was probably about 1 out of every 10 voters, but that's the same as it was in 2000. Now, there was a lot more of those voters than there were in 2000. At least we think that's going to turn out to be true. But there were a lot more voters in other age groups as well. So the mobilization wasn't as skewed toward new young voters as maybe there was some guessing that that there would be. I mean, one of the remarkable things that happened here is that we were all sort of fretting about the fact that the polls were probably misleading and that we weren't accounting for people who only use cell phones.
Yeah.
We weren't accounting for young people. We weren't accounting for first-time voters. And actually, the popular vote total looks almost exactly like what the final polls were telling us.
So those polls
were actually right.
Yeah. All right. We're very short on time, but one more call quickly. Bill and Nina, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just have a few observations.
Give us your most important one since we're so short on time.
Okay. I don't like the way the religion card was played in the campaign. Frankly, it turned me off. We're supposed to believe in the separation of church and state, and I think stirring up, religious emotions and passions, it's very polarizing. And it troubles me that the pundits are crediting the evangelical vote for putting Bush over the top. Personally, I believe in the teachings of Jesus Christ, which is love, forgiveness, and peace. I don't know how war, and particularly the Iraq war, is...
Thank you. I'm sorry, Bill, but we have less than a minute, Professor Coleman, for a response with the church and politics.
Right. Well, the reality of it is that when you look at survey data, most people respond that they want their politicians to talk about faith. They want that to be important to them. Obviously, there's an issue about how does that affect the making of public policy, but from what we can see out there, most people are comfortable with politicians talking about this, and for some voters, it's fundamentally important that they do talk about it. So that just seems to be where we are at this point.
Well, we'll leave it there. We're out of time for this hour. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks very much, Julie.
There will be more election analysis coming up here on the Ideas Network, so stay tuned. John Coleman, our guest this hour, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thanks very much to Leo Duran. He produced this hour. Thanks to Steve Zelaznik for on-air production. Thank you for listening and for calling in. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.